BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Putin travelled to Siberia, where he literally showed a flock of birds a route to the south, like a winter migratory route. He was flying what looked like a motorized paraglider, wearing white overalls, white helmets, and he was meant to look like one of those birds, and they're called the Siberian crane. Unfortunately, it didn't really work. The birds were meant to get all the way to Kazakhstan and then to Uzbekistan, and none of them did. One of them nearly got eaten by a stray dog. And the point of the whole exercise, I think, was that President Putin is really keen to be seen as a leader of men, animals, birds, Russia, everything. Very hands-on, very in charge. But the practical side of things, it doesn't always live up to expectations. I think that's the moral of the story.
To understand Vladimir Putin's rise and what he might do next, you need to understand where he's come from. And that's what we're doing in this series.
Владимир Владимирович Путин.
Впервые за всю историю нашего государства.
The leadership of President Putin offers not just hope for Russia, but also for the wider world.
I wouldn't have invited him to my ranch if I didn't trust him. I was able to get a sense of his soul.
He was a KGB agent. By definition, he doesn't have a soul.
Now we see him for what he is, a bloodstained aggressor who believes in imperial conquest.
I'm Johnny Diamond, and from BBC Radio 4, this is Putin. To make sense of the man everyone's trying to figure out, I'm joined by three people who've studied his rise.
I'm Sergei Guriev. I'm a professor of economics at Sciences Po. I'm a former rector of the New Economic School in Moscow and chief economist at the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development. I study non-democratic regimes, and we recently published a book called Spin Dictators, together with American political scientist Daniel Treisman, where we describe modern autocrats, including Vladimir Putin.
I'm Vitaly Shevchenko, the Russia editor at BBC Monitoring, and I'm a regular contributor to the BBC's Ukraine cast.
Hi, I'm Catherine Belton. I'm the author of Putin's People.
Sergei, Vitaly, thank you very much. And Catherine, welcome back. Sergei, you were working as an external economic advisor to the Russian government during the presidency of Dmitry Medvedev between 2008 and 2012. But you left Russia after Vladimir Putin became president again. Can you tell us why?
I've never worked for the government, but I was providing advice to various state companies, government bodies, on how to improve economic efficiency, economic performance. And at some point, when Mr. Putin came back in 2012, he and his closest friends started to take revenge at people who talk too much during Mr. Medvedev's presidency. And that included me. I talked too much about the importance of democracy and political competition and freedom of speech for economic development in particular. And at some point, common friends, highly ranking government officials told me, you should be outside of the country. You should not be here. And I bought a one-way ticket and left next day.
Even as an external economic advisor at a time when Vladimir Putin was only prime minister, you must have met him.
I've met him, but I would be in the room with Mr. Putin and, say, 10 other people.
And what was he like?
So Vladimir Putin is a skillful recruiter, right? His job is to convince people that he's saying what they want to hear, to convince people he's actually empathetic to them. He says things which people believe are persuasive, nice, professional. So to me, he would present himself as somebody who cares about economic policy, who wants Russia to develop and grow. The problem, of course, was that I already lived in Putin's Russia for about 10 years. And so I knew that Mr. Putin is not always an economic policymaker. He's also a corrupt autocrat who's trying to destroy whatever remained of Russian democratic institutions. But if you don't know anything about Mr. Putin, if you just meet him for the first time, you can be charmed. And that is what I observed with foreign investors. On many occasions, I saw CEOs of global companies to come to Russia, meet with Mr. Putin, and walk out with an impression that they just met a competent political leader who cares about the future of Russia, who wants to bring in foreign investment, who also knows all the numbers and cares about small details that make Russia a better destination for foreign direct investment. That is something that I saw over and over again.
Well, at the end of the last episode, summer 2018, Vladimir Putin had hosted the Football World Cup. It put Russia centre stage. He claimed to reporters afterwards that millions of people have changed their views on Russia. It's a big achievement. But all was not well on the domestic front. Catherine, Russia entered another period of protests later that year. People were demonstrating against increases in the pension age. Vladimir Putin, by the way, at this point is 65 years old. How significant do you think those protests are?
They were very significant, really, because they were the first real social protests since very early on in Putin's presidency. And it was a sign, really, that Putin was no longer able to be in a position to meet the pact that he'd made with the electorate when he first came to power. Then he was basically assuring them of rising living standards, better life. And this is no longer the case. Suddenly, his government is telling pensioners, we don't have enough funds to pay your pensions, and therefore we're going to unilaterally, almost overnight, raise your pension age. And this is one of the main guarantees a state can give to its people. People make their life plans around when they're going to retire. And at the same time, Putin's government was very openly spending huge amounts of funds on foreign military and other influence operations, and turning around to the population and saying, sorry, we can't pay our pensions. So, of course, the people were very upset.
Vitaly, involved in these pension protests in 2018 is a man called Alexei Navalny. He'd been knocking around beforehand, but here he is, sort of out on the streets. Who was he and what was he doing?
Alexei Navalny is, at that moment, Russia's most prominent opposition figure, who had come to prominence by exposing government corruption. He produced very slick videos posted on YouTube, and that was the only platform available to the Russian opposition at that time. There was no way they could feature on TV unless they were being criticized. And he did that. Alexei Navalny did that brilliantly. He attracted an audience of millions. But at this time, when people were protesting against the increase in the pension age, of course he was determined to capitalize on that. Of course he was keen to take part in it.
Sergei, did you think they were different from, for example, the protests in 2011-2012 that were pretty large when Vladimir Putin returned as president?
In 2011, protests were Moscow-based middle-class protests, and Navalny was part of that protest. In 2018, the protest was much broader, and interestingly, Navalny was no longer a richer, upper middle class Moscow guy. He was a person who connected to Russians around the country. And that, of course, scared Mr. Putin a lot, because he always wanted to position opposition leaders, including Navalny, as representatives of middle class minority. And that has changed in 2018.
And the strange thing with Alexei Navalny is Vladimir Putin never mentions his name, does he?
It's an almost mythical, mysterious feature that applies not just to President Putin, but the whole Kremlin. They seem to be unable to utter his name as though it wields some sort of mystical power. They keep calling him, or they kept calling him, that gentleman.
Sergei, you're a friend of Alexei Navalny. You're an advisor to him. Have you ever worked out why Vladimir Putin cannot bring himself to say his name?
Probably initially Vladimir Putin thought that if he refers to Alexei Navalny by a name, he points at him as an equal rival. And so he wanted to show that he doesn't know who Alexei Navalny is. And so Alexei Navalny is so unimportant that Mr. Putin has not even heard of him.
Catherine, we've talked in this series a fair amount about the oligarchs. What we haven't really discussed is how much money Vladimir Putin himself has. I mean, the Kremlin says that he has a salary of around $140,000 a year, but there is speculation that he's extraordinarily rich, perhaps even one of the richest people in the world. You've majored in on money and the Kremlin and Putin. Did you ever get to the bottom of it?
Well, you hear all these sort of crazy figures bandied around that saying that he's worth $500 billion or even more than that. But I'm afraid that the truth is a little bit more complicated. Basically, Putin's system has been set up in such a way. They've taken control of the courts. The law enforcement has carte blanche to go after whoever they like. They can be so intimidating that any Russian billionaire, any businessman of any stature, essentially has to share their wealth with the Kremlin in order to hold on to their fortunes and sort of continue to get ahead in business. One Russian tycoon told me that he said, if you get a call from the Kremlin saying, please give $1 billion or $2 billion for this or that strategic project, you can't refuse, you must comply. And all this sort of came and followed on from the 2003 arrest of Khodorkovsky, who was then Russia's richest man, and sent such a strong signal to all the other Russian billionaires that they had to toe the Kremlin line, that they only held their fortunes by remaining in the Kremlin's good graces, that eventually all of them were sort of sharing funds with the Kremlin.
The way things work in Russia, it means that President Putin doesn't necessarily need to have a bank account even to be rich. All he needs to do is pick up the phone, say the word, and he'll get it, because in a way, Putin equals Russia. And all those rich people, the oligarchs, they know what happens if they dare to say no to Putin. They lose everything. And you mentioned Mikhail Khodorkovsky, the former oil tycoon. He spent 10 years in jail. So from that point of view, asking how rich Putin is or how much money he has, it's probably the wrong question to ask, because from a certain point of view, he has everything.
The one material object that is talked about is watches, that he has a penchant for very expensive watches. And like so many of the stories that we've discussed in this series about Vladimir Putin, they sort of shape-shift when you try and get close to them. Sergei, do you know about Putin and expensive watches?
I'm not a big specialist in watches overall, but indeed, watches are a very important part of the whole story, because this is what Russian oligarchic class and Russian top political class actually uses a lot to show off. And at some point, the leading Russian business daily, Vedomosti, took their photos of Russian business people, ministers, governors, and evaluated those watches using catalogs, and showed that sometimes very modest people wear watches of $100,000 worth or $200,000 worth. But Mr. Putin would wear cheaper watches, if I can say that. I think his watches would be in the range of about $10,000. But then he would be very happy to present them as gifts to people he would meet somewhere. He goes to a factory, he meets a worker, and he just gives his watch to this worker as a gift. And then next day he has another watch exactly like this. So he had a collection of those $10,000 watches. We don't know whether he actually meets real people in recent years, because, again, investigative reporters sometimes identify the same individuals presenting themselves as workers, as sellers of ice cream. The big suspicion is that they are all presidential security officers, right? But still, we have this story of Putin donating watches to people he sees and talks to.
Vitaly.
Another thing to bear in mind as far as Putin and watches go, often they seem to show the wrong time. When you look at meetings shown by Russian state TV involving Putin and top officials, the way they're presented, it's supposed to be almost live relay. But then you look at the time and it's completely wrong. And that has led to all sorts of speculation about whether those meetings are real. Have they actually taken place? When did they take place? And it adds to this whole air of mystery surrounding Putin and the way he works. It's all smoke and mirrors and cloak and dagger, and you'll never know what the real state of affairs is. And watches, they only contribute to that.
In 2019, there are more protests, and this time it's about not allowing opposition candidates to stand in elections. What happened there?
I think what makes those protests interesting and important is the fact that they are very Moscow-centred, and yet they had an impact on political life across Russia. Opposition candidates were prevented from running in elections in Moscow to the local council, and many thousands of people took the streets, and that was one major indicator, one major factor that I think made President Putin really, really concerned about his own safety as the ultimate supreme ruler of Russia. It's the last thing he wanted to see people protesting against elections. Now, the system that he created is a sort of make-believe democracy. There are different parties who are there to create the impression of a multi-party democracy. And that's what President Putin and his officials keep mentioning when they're challenged on the issue of democracy. They would say, look, but we've got many parties. They're free to say what they want. The reality is that they are never going to realistically challenge him on major issues of policy. When it comes to real challenges, they are not allowed to run in elections. And that's what we saw when people were protesting about the fact that real challenges, they're not allowed to run. And that also applies to Alexei Navalny, the key anti-corruption campaigner. He was stopped from running for presidential elections.
And Sergei, it's 2019, as I say, and we've got these protests in Moscow about the banning of opposition candidates, but they come at the same time as the economy is slowing down, isn't it?
Yes. So by that time, it was completely clear that even though Mr. Putin came back in 2018 with a promise to accelerate economic growth, it would not happen. Exactly because Vladimir Putin built this corrupt system where his friends, his politically connected oligarchs and state-owned companies would stifle competition and economic growth. And despite all his promises, it was clear that Russia is back to stagnation, to what they would call zastoy of 1970s and 1980s. Russians saw their incomes were still remaining below the levels of pre-Crimean 2013. 2013 was the last good year in Russian economy, the last pre-war year, if you like.
You're listening to Putin, a podcast from BBC Radio 4 with me, Johnny Diamond, and my guests, Sergei Guriev, Professor of Economics at Sciences Po in Paris, Vitaly Shevchenko, Russia editor of BBC Monitoring, and Catherine Belton, author of Putin's People. Well, Vladimir Putin is into his second term of his second go at being president, but looming ahead is the seemingly immutable fact that in 2024, he'll have to stand down as his time as president will be up. And hey presto, in early 2020, a slew of constitutional changes come in. And then added to them a couple of months later is a rather important one, isn't it, Catherine?
Yes, I guess at the beginning of 2020, the parliament began discussing potential constitutional changes. And at the beginning, it looked like they were going to look for a way to sort of quietly retire Vladimir Putin, that he was going to be appointed as head of a state council, perhaps, that he could remain as a supreme leader. And that would open the way for a younger president, somebody who potentially could be seen as weak, like Dmitry Medvedev had been. Berlin, but somebody who Putin could continue to control. But after a couple of weeks of discussion, it seemed that this was also seen as too risky, that again, sort of Putin's men were worried about whether they'd be able to hold on to their extremely lucrative cash flows from the big state energy companies. And they also were increasingly fearful of what could happen if Putin didn't have his finger on the pulse of power anymore. So they came up with a solution in which basically the constitution would be changed, in which Putin could stay on as president for another 2 6-year terms.
Vitaly, around this time the COVID pandemic starts. What was the response of Vladimir Putin to the pandemic? How did Russia react?
It was the usual. Try and exploit it to your own benefit. First, unusually, he delegated decision-making to local authorities. And yet again, that showed that if their decisions to impose lockdowns or various other restrictions to do with the pandemic, the public in Russia would blame the local authorities, not him. Reports by the Kremlin's media machine, they were almost triumphant, especially towards the second half of the year, when they would speak in terms of Russia winning the battle against coronavirus, the West losing it and having to impose lockdowns and close down schools, cinemas, museums. And they would say, look at Russia, everything's open, you know, we are doing well. But unfortunately, what that led was a false sense of safety, complacency. And by the start of 2021, we had a situation when numbers, they started rising, and there was a very obvious shift, and suddenly there were urgent calls for Russians to go and get vaccinated. Another thing that I noticed when watching President Putin's response to the pandemic was that he never wears the face mask. It seems that it would apparently completely undermine his macho image. Machos never wear face masks.
We'll have more on Putin and COVID in the next episode. But in August 2020, opposition activist Alexei Navalny visits Siberia and he is poisoned. What happened, Vitaly?
On the 20th of August 2020, Alexei Navalny boarded a flight from a Siberian city called Tomsk, and his intention was to fly to Moscow. But during that flight, he collapsed due to poisoning, and there's a really heart-wrenching video of him on that flight, squirming in agony, shouting, he's in pain. There's no doubt about that. What saved Alexei Navalny was apparently a decision by the plane's crew not to fly on to Moscow, but to make an emergency landing in a city called Omsk, where he was taken to a hospital. And then after negotiations with the Russian authorities, he was airlifted to Berlin and treated there. And after he was taken to Berlin, various tests were performed, which showed that he had been poisoned with a nerve agent called Novichok.
Now, this is the same stuff that was used against Sergei Skripal, the former spy, and his daughter that killed someone who lived nearby in the English city of Salisbury back in 2018. Yeah,
that's correct. And that is one thing that makes people convinced that the Kremlin may have something to do with it, even though the Kremlin denies it.
Had Catherine Alexei Navalny actually become a threat to President Putin by this point?
Yes, I mean, obviously what happened to Navalny is a clear sign that Putin and the security service men around him had become really increasingly paranoid about his activities, that he could pose a real threat to their hold on power. At the time, he was busy in Siberia trying to organize a system of smart voting, which would bolster the vote of any candidate who wasn't really part of the Kremlin system, who wasn't part of the Kremlin's system of ruling parties and the fake parties running on behalf of the Kremlin as well. He was trying to put together a legitimate opposition that could undermine the Kremlin's hold over parliament. And there were upcoming regional elections, and Navalny is very much a threat to them.
Sergei.
I was sure that Navalny is a real threat to Vladimir Putin from early on. I was part of his team during the 2013 mayoral election. And already then, Navalny almost forced his opponent, the incumbent mayor, into a runoff. And it was clear that Vladimir Putin would do everything to make sure that Navalny can never again run in an election. So I never doubted that. But in August 2020, when I saw the news, I was really, really shocked. And I never had a doubt, any doubt, that this is a poisoning by the Kremlin.
Well, Navalny recovers after being flown to Germany, and he's determined to return to Russia, which he does at the beginning of 2021. He's arrested as he turns up, but he gets his own revenge with another of his videos posted online. This was supposedly Vladimir Putin's palace. Catherine, what was it like?
Well, it's incredibly garish. It's almost horrific what's been put on display. I mean, everyone's seen the rooms, the aqua disco, the pole dancing room, the hookah room for smoking on hookah pipes, and these sort of very lavish sort of gold-plated everything. There are lots of eagles everywhere, this great display of imperial power and wealth.
What did you read into the palace? What kind of president do you think it makes Vladimir Putin?
It makes Putin someone who, above all else, is very keen on displaying his power, demonstrating to everyone that he is the ultimate leader.
How did people in Russia react? I mean, loads of people saw it, didn't they? Vitaly?
Yes, it was Navalny's most popular video by far. 123 million views on YouTube alone. And that is extremely damaging to Putin because he has been cultivating this image of a demigod. We're not supposed to know about his family, his children even. It's a taboo subject. How he lives, where he lives, who with, you're not supposed to even mention it. And then there's a video showing, apparently, that he has this palace complete with a pole dancing room, a casino. It is something completely different from what Russians are used to hearing about Putin. It flies right in the face of this narrative of him being modest, unselfish, caring about nothing else but Russia and Russians.
And the Putin Palace video certainly isn't turning up on the evening news.
Of course not. There were denials, sort of half-hearted, you know, hints and winks, where they said that it's all untrue. It's a hotel being built by some private businessman, nothing to do with the Kremlin. But it's the kind of subject that the Kremlin will only comment on if they really, really have to.
And what did the palace tell you about the kind of president Putin is at this point?
It's not subtle. Lots of gold, lots of eagles, and the message is power and wealth. And what it tells me is that we're dealing with somebody who is determined to stay in charge for as long as he can, at whatever cost.
He has palaces throughout the country, not just in the Black Sea, but also in the north, also near Moscow, also in Siberia. And he just loves luxury. And for him, luxury is not just a consumption value. It's also a signal that he is the ultimate ruler of Russia. He is somebody similar to Russian tsars and emperors.
Sergei, Catherine, Vitaly, thank you. We leave Vladimir Putin determined to go on and on as ruler of Russia and to crush any political opponent who gets in his way. He's living and acting like a tsar, and soon his empire building will lead to another violent invasion. That's next time on Putin. Putin is presented by me, Johnny Diamond. It was produced by Caroline Bailey, Sandra Cantal and Joe Kent. The production coordinators are Sophie Hill and Siobhan Reed. The series editor, Emma Rippon. Commissioning editor, Richard Knight. This edition was mixed by Rod Farquhar, and you can subscribe now on BBC Sounds.
I'm Gabriel Gatehouse.
I'm Victoria Derbyshire.
And if you want more insights into this conflict, then please listen to Ukraine Cast on BBC Sounds.
It's a really fast-moving story, and we're trying to make sense of it together.
We're hearing heartbreaking stories from eyewitnesses on the ground, as well as getting world-class analysis from the BBC's specialist journalists.
The podcast is daily.
It's Ukraine Cast.
And it's on BBC Sounds.